All right, discipline in the classroom. Let me see a show of hands, just overall, who's been inside a classroom, children's ministry kind of a thing. Okay, cool. It's a lot of you. Can I see a show of hands again from those people who have had children in their classrooms where you either wish they weren't there or you didn't know how to deal with them? Okay. All right. Yeah, that's about what it is, you know, because discipline is really life. It's a part of life. It's discipling. It's everything that takes place with trying to corral a child. And there's often those kids that you're just praying, Lord, maybe they can go on vacation this week. And or, you know, you would hate them to get sick, but maybe a little sick, Lord, so they won't be here today. Although parents today don't really care if they're sick or not. They're going to put them in the class. We try to deal with that. Discipline has got all kinds of dynamics when you're talking about discipline in the classroom. Discipline inside a children's ministry, a Sunday school classroom, is quite different than in a home. It's just going to take up different concepts. Why? Because the teacher's not the parent. Discipline in the classroom is going to be different than at a school, homeschool. Whatever the thing is that we're going through, it's going to be done a little bit different. You've got a child for an hour, hour and a half, maybe 2 hours, once a week, maybe twice a week. It's totally different. And we're going to look at some of those aspects of why it's so different. But because it's different, because there's a whole different dynamic, it becomes confusing. And if I would ask someone that's only taught for a year, is discipline in your mind confusing? They would most likely say yes, because I'm not quite sure. I'm not quite sure whether I should or shouldn't, when I should, how I should, and what I should. We get confused by all these things partially because we have a mindset of existential thinking. We don't think that. I'm not an existentialist. But oftentimes we do think that way. And the way we know we think that way is if we don't believe there's absolute value and absolute right and wrong. Because that's what brings us into this whole realm of, well, maybe it's right today, but maybe not tomorrow. Maybe it was right for the little boy, but not for the little girl. And so we get really confused. And what that ultimately does is it breaks down standards of any kind. And we can't really find that area where we want to go and what we need to do, whether there truly is a right or a wrong. And of course, if there's not a right or wrong, then there's nothing you really can do about it. But yet you're supposed to. So now we're even more confused. So it becomes a very confusing topic. When you're involved with a discipline process, your theology is being played out, whether you know it or not. That's why sometimes it's very difficult to team teach. Because each person may have a whole different theology, how they reason the Bible to be in this area. So it becomes complicated there. There are two kinds of parents primarily. Yes, there are, you know, when you make a statement like that, you have to be careful. But you will find on an average a power-directed parent and a freedom-oriented parent. It becomes more and more problematic inside the classroom as well as inside a home. Because this is how it plays out. The freedom-oriented parent or teacher feels like their job, their only job, is to make sure that child is happy. Want them to be happy. All right? Then you have the power-directed. And that power-directed teacher or parent feels like that this freedom-oriented teacher or parent is way out. And so what I have to do is get entrenched, and this is the way it's going to be, and this is how it's going to be. All right. So you have these two very opposite, across-the-line kind of parents or teachers. And what happens is they both get entrenched in their position because the power-directed kind of like, you know, you're doing it military style. You know, you're... this is the way it is. There's not going to be any variation from it. And so the freedom-oriented teacher or parent starts getting entrenched because they're going, man, that one is so, like, there's no area of gray. They're just totally military. So I'm going to become more freedom-oriented. and the power directive sees them more freedom oriented, and they become more entrenched in the power directed way. And neither one of them ever come to the middle because they don't know how to come to the middle. And so they become more and more entrenched. And a lot of counseling that takes place in the church, and a lot of counselors do not even recognize this as a major problem because it's not something that gets talked about. But it's what plays out in homes. And then the child becomes extremely confused and typically lacks discipline. Why? Well, the freedom-oriented never gave them any structure to become disciplined. And the power-directed forced them to be disciplined, so they never had to really think about being disciplined. And then they leave home, and they're like, wow, what's this about? I mean, many of you have recently left home. I know when I was 18 and I went away to school, it was like, whoa, man, who's going to do my laundry? It was like a real shock. It was like, what? I mean, hasn't God brought that person along to do my laundry all this time? Where they aren't going to come along, you know? And all the different things. Cook my meals? Well, here comes the TV meals. And it was like, oh, I don't know how to cook. You know? Oh, McDonald's is fast. That'll only kill you in about a year. But, you know, it's like... So you leave home and you're like, oh, I'm confused. And so now we get inside a children's ministry class. Man, I know God's calling me to teach the kids. And you get teamed up and it gets confusing. I'm going to bring that together, by the way, by the time we're done in class. I'm going to bring the freedom oriented, the power directed together to where there is an answer to that, to where both people need to come together for a whole different idea. Because God will use the power directed personality and the freedom-oriented personality. I think that's a part of it. I'm not saying that that's wrong, but when it gets way out against the wall, that's when it becomes very wrong and very confusing. So, those kind of things happen in this process of discipline, which makes it, as I said, quite confusing. And so it kind of neutralizes a person sometimes for how and why and do I go ahead and discipline or not. So, we're going to try to answer some of those questions there. All right, number two on your outline, why does our Heavenly Father discipline His children? And we're going to take a look at Hebrews 12. We're going to start with verse 5 and go through 13. Hebrews 12, verse 5. And you have forgotten the exhortation which speaks to you as to sons. My son, do not despise the chastening of the Lord, nor be discouraged when you are rebuked by Him. For whom the Lord loves, He chastens and scourges every son whom He receives. If you endure chastening, God deals with you as with sons. For what son is there whom a father does not chasten? Verse 8. But if you are without chastening, of which all have become partakers, then you are illegitimate and not sons. Furthermore, we have had human fathers who corrected us, and we paid them respect. Shall we not much more readily be in subjection to the Father of spirits and live? For they indeed for a few days chasten us as seemed best to them. But He for our profit, that we may become partakers of His holiness. Now no chastening seems to be joyful for the present, but painful. Nevertheless, afterwards it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. Therefore, strengthen the hands which hang down and the feeble knees, and make straight paths for your feet, so that what is lame may not be dislocated, but rather be healed. So the question is, why does our Heavenly Father discipline us? Anyone? Because He loves us. All right? Right there in verse 6, because He loves us. Now, why is that so important? First, we're supposed to be representing Him. And if you are not directly involved with loving and love, when you are disciplining, you are then not disciplining, you are punishing. And we'll talk about the difference between punishment and discipline, but it's very important Jesus never poured out discipline apart from love. And if we lose sight in that, then we're lose sight in what is extremely important for us to understand. Verse 10 talks about, "For they indeed for a few days chastened us as seemed best to them, but he for our profit," I like this, "that we may be partakers of his holiness." Anybody want to be like Jesus? There you go. Partakers of his holiness. Okay? For you who want to be like Jesus, when was the last time you asked him in your morning devotion to discipline you that day? Pretty usual. You don't go around thinking, "Hey, Lord, discipline me today, please." Why? See, the deal is we have a bad concept of discipline. We don't understand what God is saying when he disciplines us in love. Because he wants us to become partakers of his holiness. And see, discipline, the root goes to disciple. To build up. But we think of the negative term of discipline often. Even in the scriptures that we use to apply for parenting for children. It's usually pretty sick. Well, I don't know if I can use that word. Didn't that mean cool now? Okay, I don't know. And I can't say bad, because you know that may be good. So this is getting complicated here. So anyway, hopefully you know what I'm saying. Verse 11. We can't overlook this. All this is being talked about for those who have been trained by it. There is a training process that is important. And it's not a discipline in the concept of beating a child. It's not a discipline of taking away privileges. You know, taking away privileges is really only getting their attention. And yet it's used as a discipline. And it's not a discipline. It's just to get their attention. To then discipline. But the problem is, generation after generation after generation has been dumbed down. The family has been broken apart. My parents were not capable of caring for me in the way they should have, nor my wives. And I go back and I look, and their parents, our grandparents, were not capable. So who do we blame? Shouldn't blame anybody. In reality, it's the way it's played out. What we need to do is say, okay, I didn't get equipped. So what am I going to do? Am I going to carry on that heritage to the next generation? Or am I going to wake up and say, I'm done with that. I'm done with that wrong way of caring for kids. Now, the cool thing about this, and you got to keep balance with me because we're talking about God here. I don't care what kind of family you came up from. It don't matter. Because God's bigger and greater than that family. God can turn it all around for the good, for those who love him and are called according to his purposes. So I don't like hearing people whining and complaining about, well, my mom or my dad, get over it. You're going to let them hold you back? And did they have all the resources they need? I personally believe most parents care for their kids the best they know how, because it didn't get passed down the line. And a lot of times that's inadequate. But we'll go through life blaming them. And you know who loses? Not the parents. Those who are blaming them. Because they never get over it, and they never get past it, and they never grow from it. Life's not fair. Anybody? You know? Anybody think it's fair? First time, huh? Yeah, right. But we play it out sometimes like it's supposed to be. And it's not. So my encouragement to you, if you're hanging on to something that was wrong, that you were wronged, get over it, give it to God, and move on and find out how you can change and break that generation curse and now allow God to guide and to lead and to direct and to become who he wants you to be. Because the best of parents aren't even close to God himself being your father. I mean, that means a lot to me, not having a father, that he is my father. But the best aren't going to lead you down the road that he's going to lead you down. They're going to do their best. But he's greater than the best. And it's so important for us to get over that. It hurts. It hurts because we keep holding on to the bitterness. My wife told me, I don't know, many years ago, she goes, you don't know how many times I had to forgive my parent, one of her parents. You know, I'd get upset at how they would treat her when, you know, we'd go over to the house. And I just couldn't understand how, you know, blood can treat them. You know, I just couldn't understand. And she finally told me what she was doing. And I never even realized it for years. She said, I have to forgive them. I have to constantly forgive them. Because if I don't, I can become bitter. And my bitterness eats me up, not them up. I thought, wow, that's pretty powerful to always be forgiving. You know, instead of holding in resentment. I can understand why she wanted to keep going back. Why do you want to keep going back to that? And her answer is, well, it's my parents. You know, and it's like, your parents are like treating you like, yeah, and I forgive. Jesus said something about that. If we don't forgive somebody, what was the end of that? Yeah, he's not going to forgive us. Oh, well, that's for the other guy down the street. All right, let's go ahead and take a look at number three. Why do children misbehave? Probably the most obvious reason children misbehave is the most overlooked. That first bullet there. Because they're sinners. Because you're a sinner. Because we are sinners, but kids are more open. I mean, their sin is like totally, like right there in your face. Which makes parents oftentimes think their kids are worse than most. The question I often ask is, what's the difference between a little sinner, my hand way down here, and way up here, a big sinner? What's the difference? What? That's it. The bigger sinner hides it. The little sinner is just wide open. Like, well, isn't that what you're supposed to be? Honest? Mommy, you're lying. You know, it's like, that's the only difference. You know, some of those kids aren't even saved. And oftentimes parents ask the kids that aren't saved to be better than they are with the enabling power of the Holy Spirit living in their lives. That's why I believe that it's extremely important for young conversion. Because then the child's got the Holy Spirit living inside, the enabling power of living life out. Apart from him, you do nothing. So, first one, little sinners. I had a mom with a three-year-old one time, and it was a long time ago. We had a couple three-year-old classes, about 30 kids in each one, and she was like, my kid. And I'm going, the kid's right there, and I thought it was pretty cute and acting like a three-year-old and so forth. And so I said, you know what, I don't normally do this, but why don't you go in and observe our three-year-old class. Bring your child in, and you can watch your child run around and do what the other three-year-olds are doing, and you can see it. And so that happened. She came back after service, and she kind of looked at me and didn't really know what to say. And she finally got it out, and she said, you know, my three-year-old's a lot like those other three-year-olds. I said, you're right, and that's the deal. There is age appropriate in life. I mean, we grow, and we keep growing. Now, if you have a 10-year-old that's acting like a three-year-old, you've got a problem. It's time for them to grow up. But there's stages of life that we go through. All right, the next one is discouragement. Kids can come in and they can be misbehaving because they're discouraged. I mean, there's all kinds of reasons for being discouraged, for sure. Do any of you ever get discouraged? Probably not. Never mind. I didn't know that. We all get discouraged. You know why? Because we all like ourselves so much. We really like ourselves. And you know what? When things happen that are bad, you know, if we didn't like ourselves, some people claim they don't like themselves, and they'd be happy that those things were happening because they didn't like themselves, those bad things. No, we like ourselves, and so we get discouraged. We think life should be better for me than that. Come on. It's really quite profound, I guess you would say, to think of yourself as deserving hell. And as you go through life, if anything good comes along, then you should be happy. But discouragement is constant inside the classroom, and you can see the discouragement walk in. And you can have one or two choices that you can react to that. Ah, discouragement. I'm going to take care of that. I'll make sure they leave this class and they aren't looking discouraged anymore. I'll sit them down and I'll talk with them and I'll let them know what's up. Yeah, right. Or, wow, discouraged. I can see that all over their face. I need to pray for them. I need to love on them big time today to let God do a work in their life. We have choices. Next one is ignorance of rules. They don't know what you expect when they walk inside your classroom. It's not like, you know, and you may think this, that their life revolves around your hour and a half classroom. It does not. They oftentimes don't even remember some of the stuff, unless they've been going week after week. But there's all kinds of kids that come once a month, every 3 weeks, you know, once a year, whatever it is. And so they may not have the same understanding of what the rules are, so it's important. And we'll talk about the rules that you explain those. It's not what you think that matters. This is a little plaque I have up on my office. It's not what you think that matters. It's what you communicate. It's what you communicate. We often think that everybody thinks the way we think. And they know what we think. Especially the kids. They don't. It's what you communicate to them. That's what matters. Next one is frustration. Kids come in frustrated. They may not come in frustrated, but then because of what happens in class, they become frustrated. A couple main ways they do become frustrated after not being frustrated when they come to class. One is the teacher doesn't know anything about how to control a class, and the class is wacko wild. So they have this brilliant idea. I've heard this said somewhere, and so I'm going to try it. I'm going to put the chairs in a circle. And then I'm going to seat them, boy, girl, boy, cootie, boy, girl, you know. And that's what a third grade may think. I got to sit next to this guy, girl. They'll be quiet. No, not want to come back to class ever again. And the teacher says, yeah, I got it down. And they don't know that they're frustrating a child. Here's another way that oftentimes happens that you get frustrated. All right, we're going to read these 45 verses. And what we're going to do, because we just want to make sure all of you get involved here in class, we're going to start down here, and we're going to read all the way down, and we're going to come back this way and come back that way, and we'll be back to that 45th verse. All right? Sounds reasonable. Except if you have a problem reading, or if you are extremely shy. I was a kid that had a problem reading in elementary school. You know what was better for me? Is to do something stupid, goof off in class, and get kicked out of class so I didn't have to read. That does cause discipline problems. I always recommend you call on volunteers for reading out loud. Always enough volunteers. There's always enough kids that want to read. They have no problem with it. They're skilled with it. I mean, there's even times when kids aren't necessarily even skilled with it and they'll still read, but it's their choice. I had a time in a third grade class that I used to teach in third grade a number of years ago. I still remember his name and his grandfather who cared for him. And his grandfather, we became well acquainted. But anyway, Bobby couldn't read at all. And so I would ask for volunteers, and hands would go up, and his never went up. you know. And all of a sudden one day, his went up. And I'm thinking, well, what's up? This is not like, I don't want to call him Bobby. Because I know he can't read. And so I was calling everybody else. And I was getting down to there was only Bobby left. And so I called on Bobby. And what took place blew my mind. It's even hard for me to even this many years later share this. But Bobby started to read. And sure enough, Bobby couldn't read. And he was butchering the words. He couldn't even come close to some of the words. And all of a sudden, somebody on his right or left said the word. And so he would repeat it. And then he'd come to another and stumble. And then a kid on the other side would give the word. And he went all the way through the verse. And at the end of that time, the class applauded. That's a safe class. That's a class that the kids felt loved, cared for. And it took a while before he did that. Many months. But you can have a classroom that's safe for the kids, probably the only safe place that they may have in their life, and they'll never forget it. They'll never forget it. Don't force them to read. Next one is boredom. Another reason kids act out. They're just simply bored. Teacher may be teaching over their head or under. The teacher most likely, in that scenario, isn't preparing for their class. And of course they're bored. Anybody would be bored with the way half these classes are. And you know what kids realize is when a teacher hasn't prepared? This is what they realize. Not that the teacher's dumb. The teacher doesn't care. This teacher doesn't care. They're here, I don't know why, but the teacher doesn't care. Classes that are teaching the Word of God shouldn't be boring. But we can make them boring. And, you know, a child who is bored will last in that state of being bored maybe 60 seconds. More like 30. And then they're going to find something that unbores them, so to speak. And that's when you better know every kind of technique for discipline on earth. Because they're bored. A number of our classes, it's just phenomenal. Kids don't even want to leave the class when it's over with. They're so tied into relationships. Parents are like going, come on, come on. You know? I love that because relationships are what it is about. Next one is home-related problems. Kids will come in and they will misbehave because they got home-related problems going on. And oftentimes you don't know about those home-related problems because I do know things about our church and counsel and understand things. I see happy families every week. The next week, the father's not there anymore or the mother's not there anymore. Or there's a restraining order, a court order. You know, home-related problems are real. 50% of marriages, and man, who would want to get married with this statistic? End up in divorce. So we'll just hang out together, you know. We won't solidify it. They end up in divorce too. But you know what's worse? That's a world standard. In the church today, 50% of marriages end up in divorce. That means half your class somehow, some way has experienced or is experiencing it, and it's much higher than half because you've got cousins and nephews, and it's just a big mess. So they're coming in. You know, I still remember when my dad left. I remember sitting on my mom's lap, looking out the window, going, where's he going with all of this stuff? 9 years old. Where's he going? I went to church that next day. What do you think I was thinking then? Life's so pretty. Not at all. And that's the kind of child that can be coming into the classroom. And if you look at that child and you go, you know what, they got an attitude and I'm going to care for that attitude, you shouldn't be in that class. You shouldn't be near kids. because a lot of kids have a lot of attitudes. We're supposed to be there standing in the gap for them. That's what it's about. And when you stand in the gap, God will use you in a mighty way. So home-related problems is a real deal. It's a tough thing. There will be times during the prayer time that kids will start opening up and telling you what it is. So, man, what do I do with this information? Woo! And I say, you pray about that information. You don't send that information anywhere else. Unless it has to do with child abuse, and we'll have a class talking about that. And there's a different standard for that. But there's a lot of things you just got to keep to yourself and pray for those kids. Now, you also have to understand during prayer times, what the kids are praying aren't always true. They may have seen a movie the night before, and they thought it was a really cool kind of line of thinking, and so they'll try it out on you. Now, I don't know if that's what happened one time, but my wife and I used to teach kindergarten together. And in our little prayer time, sitting on the floor, we had a youngster pray for his uncle, who lost his arm. We're like, oh, whoa. So we're praying seriously for this uncle who lost his arm. And the way we worked our class is I took care of the kids when the sign out was happening. Barb always signed them out and talked with the parents. And she goes, parent came and said, we're really sorry about it. He said, his uncle, is that your brother? She goes, what? Well, we're really sorry. We prayed for him. You prayed for him? Why? Well, because he lost his arm. What? He didn't lose his arm. He's fine. I said, okay. You know, what do you say after that? It's like, you got a lying son. You know, so not all the time when kids are praying, you got to kind of really be careful about some of the stuff when prayer time goes on. But it's confidential stuff. When the child gets to the place where they feel free to share the truth, it's really important that you understand that. All right. Next one is, do not provoke a child to anger, lest they be discouraged. And what I'd like you to do right now is take a couple minutes and think about, like in a classroom situation, what we could possibly do to discourage a child. I mean, we've talked about some of these things, but what would it be that you would see that could provoke a child? All right, so think through that, write them down, and we'll talk about them in a minute. One of the things that is often done to provoke a child is to belittle them, you know, to make fun of them. And, you know, kids do some crazy stuff. Sometimes you just got to hold your tongue because your words are powerful to them. You're the God people in their lives. Anybody else? Any ideas? Yeah. Ignoring them. Yeah, I mean, it's like the worst possible thing that you can do in some regards is to ignore them. Now, there are circumstances in which ignoring sometimes have to take place when they're interrupting and doing things. But when it's time, you get back to that child as best you can, you know, however that would be. So, yeah. Yeah. Right. And that's kind of along the line of, you know, say what you mean what you say and do it. Yeah. Favoritism. Whoa, big time. That got a lot of your hands down. Yeah, favoritism. How does favoritism play out? Okay. Okay. Is there any other way besides what Stephen just said? Favoritism. Okay, now that's getting where I'm headed. Paying more attention. Now, is there any other thing besides that? Bingo. Yeah. We oftentimes think of favoritism as the special child, the sweetheart, the friendly one, the one that's pleasant to deal with. But favoritism also happens with the child that's acting out. And you can spend more attention with that child than anybody else. And you know what? The rest of the class will become pretty annoyed by it either way, because they can read right through it. They can see it. And typically that kind of a scenario is you don't know what to do with that child. It's like the child's acting out and you're like going, I don't know what to do with that child. Happens to be the pastor's son. Yeah, well, if you're called to oversee the children's ministry, whether it's the pastor's son or not, you better do something. Because it's not about respecters of persons. It's about caring for an individual child and the importance of that care. And the abuse happens when pastor kids get treated special. Because then they get out into the real world. Bingo again. And the real world goes, who cares? And you don't know how to deal with that. And I have sought with all my heart, my wife too, is not to do that with our own. And I believe that we've accomplished that. Because they're people. They're real people. They aren't more special than anybody else. Christ died for them the same as he died for anybody else. So we have to be careful when we're doing this favoritism thing. Either way. Either way. Any others? Yeah. Totally. The pressure is bad news. Totally. Again, it's, I'm not sure why. I mean, it's like, I think it's just the lack of experience. A teacher feels like, oh, everybody's got to do it as a group. And that's really bad in the preschool years. In the preschool years, kids are developing at all different kinds of speeds and rates. And so this is what I do with the preschool age. I tell the teachers, don't force the child in front for the Bible study for any reason. If they encourage them highly, get them in a habit, in a routine. But if you've got kids, three or four kids that are active as could be, have them in the background area. Don't bring them up front and let them do their thing while the rest of the class is listening. It's okay. Because those kids that are doing their thing, they're listening. And then I tell the teacher, ask them questions too when you're done with your Bible study and ask the questions. And they'll know them. We had a kid in our kindergarten class. And we had him for almost 2.5 years because we had 5 years old. And then kindergarten, they could be 6. And we let him stay a year longer. He was 7. And this kid was, I don't even know the letters behind his name. I mean, he had so many different issues going on. And our goal, the first year we couldn't get there, but our goal was to get him to at least have his hand on his chair at any given time. All right, that was our goal. It took over a year to get there. But there was a time when we got there and the chair had to be in the front row. We had to have him near us because we do worship, we'd be up front and so forth, and we just had to have him there. And I played the guitar, and my wife was doing the singing. I was singing too. And all of a sudden, she looks at me, and I'm not paying attention to him. And her eyes are going down while we're singing. I'm just going, I mean, it's like, what's he doing? You know, and we kept on trying to play the song. He was on his head, still touching the chair, and spinning, slowly, just spinning around. And I was going, oh. Now, there's all kinds of kids, all right? And most kids understand those kids. You know, as long as we play it out, we're okay. We still can do class. That kid who was spinning on his head was hearing the worship songs. But, you know, you've got to be aware that these kind of things take place. They happen, and you've got to find a way to make it work. I had a teacher come to me about a child that was way out. He was a first grade teacher many years ago. And he goes, I've got to tell the parents. I've got to tell the parents. What do you got to tell the parents? I've got to tell the parents about their kid. Well, what do you mean? He's like way out there. He's acting out. He's doing all this stuff. Okay, so you got to tell his parents what you're seeing in this hour and a half. Yeah. I said, do you know where that kid is the rest of the time? Do you not understand that he's with them? And it may be new to you, but it's not new to them. So do everything you can to give them that hour and a half break. Make it work. You know, having letters behind your name isn't a big deal. You know, sometimes we think it's the end of life. We're so like separated out in our society. We hide the things that we don't feel comfortable with. Come on. God has brought that for a purpose, yes. ADD, any letter that's out there, the most current thing, you know. It's like God's got variety. And you know, we've kind of messed things up too along the way. So, all right, kind of getting off there. Anything else? Meddling in their life, that's not good with anybody. Amen, yeah. Not getting what they want, it depends on what they want. So there can be, that can be part of it, and they can do all kinds of stuff with that. Yeah. How would you have a preconceived idea about a child? Yeah, no, yeah, I know what you're saying. I ask that for a reason, because we do that all the time, and it's bad. Just imagine if God, who has preconceived ideas about us, would treat us that way, knowing that 10 years ago this is the way I was. Every child has a fresh start when they come in a children's ministry class. They have to have it. And this is how it plays out. You know what your big time problems are, especially in elementary? Kids that like each other. Kids that haven't seen each other for a while. They may only get a chance to see them on Sunday. Oh, I mean, come on. We're going to use this time up fully. And you're telling me to be quiet? I only have an hour and a half here. You know, that's how these kids are reasoning, man. They're just so happy to be together. And even if they do see each other every 3 or 4 days in a week, they're still happy to be together. So this is how that plays out. What you're talking about is they come in the next week and there's 3 of them and they're always doing the same thing, making trouble because they keep on talking, they're happy about it. So now they come in and you go, okay, you sit over there, and you sit here. Well, there's 3 problems with that. The first is preconceived because they haven't done anything yet. But you know they're going to do it. You know, they're going to do it. So you need to work with them and say, you know what? This is what I could do, but I'm not going to do that. And I want you to grow and mature, and we're going to try to work this thing out here so that I don't have to move you. And the second problem with moving kids that are talking all the time, they're over here, and they're over here. Now they've got the class surrounded. throw a piece of paper with a note over here, you know, hi over there, and oh, they aren't paying attention, so how about you now? And so they're talking to the person next to them. So now you have another problem. So there's all kinds of stuff to happen. Any other ways? Embarrassing them. Totally. You know, that's about, you know, the belittling, the embarrassing, breaking promises. You haven't come up with one of them yet that I'm looking for. Yeah. Yeah, now, there's times when correction... Let me give you an illustration. Most of our classes, there's at least 2 teachers in them, and so the correcting takes place by the secondary teacher, and they take them outside and they talk with them and deal with them. But there's times when, I know I've experienced when I was teaching and the co-teacher didn't make it that day, and so I would tell the class, I'd be up front with them, I said, look, correction is part of the job, and my co-teacher ain't here. So when I correct you, I'm going to correct you in front of your peers. And I give them a warning. I let them know, hey, it's coming. It's coming your way. And I have no choice because I am not going to let you play like an idiot. So it helps. But when you have the capability of correcting them in private, you must. That's what you're getting at, right? Yeah, and that's so important. So important. Anything else? Laughing at them. Well, they're funny. These kids are funny. Why not laugh? Yeah, and that's the difference. Laughing at and laughing with. you know. Don't laugh at kids. Don't, you know, it's like, don't do that. And there'll be times when they'll do laughable stuff. So turn around and laugh, but don't let them see you laugh. All right? And what do you mean being there all the time? You mean being at class that week? Yeah, that gets into the parental kind of a thing. And yeah, but that does bring up something that's important. I do a system of children's ministry that I'm hoping other places do, but oftentimes not. And what it is when a person's prayed about coming into the children's ministry, what they're saying when they say yes to that at our church is they're going to be there every week. Forever in that one class that they've been designated to. And most of my teachers meet that standard. Why? Because the kids are worth it. I have teachers that take a vacation, and they take the vacation from Sunday afternoon after their class until Saturday night so they can be back in their class. Those kids are looking forward to that teacher. And if you hit and miss, there's churches that only have like 3 months on and 3 months off, 6 months on, 6 months off. It will never, I guarantee, I don't care how big the church is, how little the church is, how great everybody thinks the church is, it will never become a strong children's ministry. It will not. It can't. Any rotation like that, it can't. Now you can have rotation within that strong every week. We have a few classes, younger age classes, where we'll rotate the same person, will support, same two people will be supporting in that one class on the first Sunday of every month, the second Sunday, and so forth. But we already have teachers that are in there every week, so it works fine. But the majority of our teachers, some people call it the burnout system. But you talk to most of the teachers, and it's not. And I've done this with volunteers. The most volunteers, because we did it this way, was about 250 volunteers that were there every week, rain or shine. If they were sick, or they had vacation, or they had a trip or something, you know, it wasn't like they were forced not to live. Well, let's say they were gone 3 or 4 weeks out of that year. They were there 48. And the kids became stronger and stronger in relationship with them. And the ministry is at peak level when you have a teacher there that long. So it is key. Here's the one I was looking for. You got it? Yeah. Absolutely. And if you're doing that, you aren't in control. Control doesn't argue. Control says, this is it. This is the way it goes. Yeah. Oh, dude. Yeah. Yeah, and that's a weird thing. That's wrong, and it happens. It's so weird how people are. I'll show you how weird I can get when I'm driving in my car with my wife, and my daughters are behind us. And we have a Highlander, not a big car. So what, that distance between the back and the front during Christmas time, we'll start whispering to each other about, hey, wouldn't this be good? And our daughters, they hear every word, and yet we're so foolish to think they don't hear anything. Parents do that all the time. You've been in a car like that? Oh, I can't believe they're talking about that. Same thing can happen in a classroom. Two teachers talking about stuff they shouldn't be talking about. Matter of fact, we have a rule, no talking for the kids, no talking about movies or games in class. But teachers will start talking about movies that they've seen. Whoa. In front of the kids. I wouldn't admit it in front of anybody. And it's not shocking because we've got five-year-olds seeing R-rated movies. I mean, it's like my wife teaches kindergarten. She can't believe the stuff that they're allowed to see. Yeah. Hypocrisy. How's that work? Yeah. Well, that's often what happens. Yeah. Well, that was a rule for last week. Well, what's this week? You know. Yeah, and we're going to talk about that to give yourself that. Well, the thing I was looking for, you guys all flunked. Unless you said it and I wasn't awake. Teasing. All right, now. There's a realm of teasing when the child is involved with it and likes it that's acceptable. And that's usually about 10 to 15% of teasing. But 85 to 90% of teasing, kids hate. And why does it go on? Because you're the big guy and they're the little guy. And what can they do about it? And that's the way it is with parents. There's a point of teasing that's acceptable teasing. But oftentimes what teasing is doing is it's making fun of something about the child. And you know, like in a parent-child relationship, the dad's teasing the craziness out of the child and kind of smiling and trying to, you know, say with some kind of honor, yeah, stop this, you know. And they'll come out and say, stop this. And that will make sometimes the teasing go even more. Kids hate teasing. They don't like it as a whole. It's belittlement. It's putting down, you know. Can you imagine a classroom? Let's say you're teaching first graders, you know, you got those six-year-olds in there and you walk in the classroom, they all start teasing you. That'd like be bizarre. It's like, whoa. But it's all right for a teacher to go tease. No, it's not all right. So, enough with teasing. These are some of the things that will provoke children. So, since I don't want to provoke you children, it's time for a break.